Okay, thank you very much for inviting me here. And my talk will be devoted to the, actually my sequence of talks will be devoted to different type of inverse problem than was discussed earlier. It will be Gelfand inverse boundary spectral problem. Now, it will be one of many Gelfand boundary spectral problems, and particularly the following one. I will not be very sort of different from people who were speaking before me, because I'll also consider Laplace operator on Riemann manifold. I think that's, we decided how to write it. So we have a Riemann manifold that will be compact, connected, and C infinity with non-empty boundary. And I will consider Laplace operator with Neumann boundary condition. Laplace U, DJU, that already was several times introduced in these lectures. And of course, this is a representation in some local coordinates, in local coordinates. And just for this lecture, assume that we are looking for the Neumann problem. So we put the dun on the boundary in zero. Now, what will be Gelfand boundary? It's just operator. I'm looking at it as an operator. So that's an operator with a domain normal condition, normal derivative of the boundary is zero. So that's an operator. And it has a spectrum, discrete spectrum, since we assume that everything is compact. So the spectrum is lambda 1 is 0, less than lambda 2, and so on. And it has corresponding eigenfunctions. So phi 1, that is just constant function, that's the volume to the power 1/2, minus 1/2. And then phi 2, and so on. And we assume that eigenfunctions are form of a normal basis. In L to M. So you see, there's a spectral problem. So it is clear for where the word boundary spectral problem comes, because Gelfand boundary spectral data for this problem will be the following one. Gelfand boundary spectral data for this problem, defined boundary spectral data, is collection. Well, we have the boundary. We have pairs, eigenvalues, and values on the boundary of eigenfunctions. So we have all eigenvalues and restrictions to the boundary of these orthonormal eigenfunctions. Now, let me tell you a couple of words how these Gelfand boundary spectral data are related to Dirichlet and Neumann map that was introduced in the previous lectures. Or better here to speak about Neumann to Dirichlet map. And the relation is the following. If you look for the equation Laplace U equals to lambda U, and normal derivative of U of the boundary is F, then we have Neumann to Dirichlet map that will depend upon lambda. Well, let me use the same attention. Lambda capital of lambda of F will be the value of the solution UF lambda on the boundary. Okay? So we are looking for the family of this equations parameterized by spectral parameter lambda. And then for each spectral parameter lambda, we have an analog of Neumann Dirichlet map. So this Neumann Dirichlet map from F to the value on the boundary of the solution will, of course, depend on parameter lambda. And actually, Gilfand boundary spectral data are equivalent to the fact that we know this Neumann Dirichlet map for lambda belonging to the resolvent set of Laplacian. So this means that we know this Neumann Dirichlet map not for one frequency, but for many frequencies. Actually, this lambda of lambda is a meromorphic operator valued function, so it's not a question of all lambdas, but the question of lambdas with some accumulation point. Now, another equivalent formulation that actually Adrian mentioned in his talk is related to the wave equation. So we can consider the wave equation related to our Laplace operator. And the problem will be like that. Let me put it here because I don't want to touch it. So we look for the wave equation UTT plus Laplacian U equals to zero in M. U for t equals to 0 equals to ut for t equals to 0 equals to 0. So nothing was in the past. And we have a source, Neumann source on the boundary, d nu u on the boundary dm cross r plus is boundary source f. It's not really good, but let me put it f capital because it's a time-dependent source. It's not like there. So it's time-dependent source. And we assume it's enough, actually, to assume that this time-dependent source belongs to C dot infinity of dm cross r plus. So we look for this initial boundary value problem for the wave equation. And we put boundary sources, time-dependent boundary sources from this class. What does it mean? What does this mean dot mean? This means that we are looking for the functions equal to 0 near t equals to 0. Okay. And then we have a non-stationary, or hyperbolic, Neumann Dirichlet map. So we have a map, R hyperbolic, that maps f to uf back on the boundary. Okay. We can actually consider this map not for all times, because I have only 2 hours, but for some limited times. So we take it not to R plus, but say to 0 T capital. Okay? And then again, as I said, Gilfand boundary spectral data are equivalent to a prescription of the Neumann Dirichlet map for lambda being any spectral parameter from resolvent set, but is also equivalent to the fact that we know this hyperbolic Neumann Dirichlet map for sufficiently large t. I don't want to tell now what sufficiently large t. I'll probably tell if not forget at the end of the lectures, or if you wouldn't forget to ask me. Okay? There are some other equivalent formulations of the Gilfand boundary spectral data, but let's for a moment stop with these three ones. I especially would like to point your attention that, and I wouldn't delete it, I hope, because though I'll be speaking about boundary spectral problem, it is actually has hyperbolic nature, so that initial boundary value problem for the wave equation is very important. Now, let me, again, not being very, very different from other people, explain how non-uniqueness goes into business. Even, well, let me put in differently. You know, yesterday when Adrian was speaking here, he said, well, for those who are from applications, assume that's not a manifold, it's a domain in Rn, R3, presumably R2. So for those who are from applications, also for some British mathematicians who don't know that there is something except for domains for in R3, let me show how manifolds go into the business when we have even domains on R3. And again, I'm not here very different. If you just have that our M lies in Rn, then, and we have, well, we used F, phi, psi, let me put X as a diffeomorphism from M to M. And X on the boundary is identity. And then, as we already know, that, well, not particularly, because we know it for the Neumann Dirichlet map, and here is a defined boundary spectral data, but still the situation is the same. So if you have a metric G, Gij, in M, and if we construct from metric, if we go from the metric G to the metric Gij tilde, that is, well, people prefer push forward, let me use push forward of G. Okay, then it's not only Dirichlet to Neumann map, but all defined boundary spectral don't change. Because basically what we do, we go from description of our functions u as function of x to the new functions u tilde of, say, y, where y is x capital of x. Okay? So, in particular, all eigenfunctions go to eigenfunctions. And all eigenvalues remain the same. So after this transformation, we have that lambda k tilde, the eigenvalues of Gij tilde, are the same as eigenvalues of Gij. And we have that phi k tilde as a point y equals to phi k at the point x, when y is just x capital of x. Okay. So this is well known for us all the reason for non-uniqueness that persists also for this more data, for Gilfand boundary spectral data that we need to take into account. And to take into account is mathematically means that we just need to formulate our problem in coordinate invariant form. And this means exactly that we have with a manifold. The other reason why manifolds appear even for those who don't know nothing except for domains in R3 is the following. Though it will not be in the lectures, also Olli Günther mentioned it, and it's also maybe done by this technique. If you have a domain and we know sort of exterior boundary of this domain, it may sometimes happen that the domain can have holes that we don't know from a priori. So therefore, you know, assuming that we have a domain, the existence of holes means that topological type has changed. So again, we need to look at manifolds. And the last reason why manifolds appear in real life, because I believe in real life, any of us have seen some surfaces. And that's exactly two-dimensional manifolds. For example, I think that in real life, you sometimes have seen surfaces like that. For example, just 10 minutes ago. Okay? So you see that really, even we are going to work in our R3, it is quite natural when we deal with anisotropic inverse problems to speak about manifolds. Now, that's the first remark. The second remark somehow will be a bit new because there is another reason for non-uniqueness in inverse problems. There's another reason for non-uniqueness of inverse problems. Let us look at a more general second-order elliptic operator. So let A be second-order elliptic operator on manifold MDM, Now, in this moment, I don't assume that there is any Riemann metric, but there is a measure, a smooth measure, d mu. Okay? And I assume that my second order elliptic operator is self-adjoint. But of course, there are some boundary conditions of local type. So, Dirichlet and Neyman are third order. And assume that my operator is self-adjoint. Self-adjoint. In L2 with a measure dm, d mu. Well, if the corresponding boundary conditions say will be of the third type, so third type, basically this means that is condition for du d nu normal derivative plus sigma u. Okay, then we can ask formulate the same defined boundary spectral problem. For this operator, well, because our M is compact and because basically our M is compact, the spectrum is discrete and there are eigenfunctions form orthonormal basis and we can consider the same data. Okay? And we can form the same question. Can we recover given boundary of the manifold? Now we come to the problem. Can we recover given boundary of the manifold and these pairs, can we come from here to M, well, in this case, A, and d mu? Now, because we are speaking about Riemann manifold, we are not afraid about changes of coordinates, but still there is some group of non-uniqueness that appears here. And that's the group of gauge transformations. We can assume, but I'm not going to do it, that operator A has first order terms that are not real, so there appears magnetic potential. But let me speak about the case when operator A has all coefficients real. Then what we can do the following trick. We can go from function u to function v that is kappa multiplied by u, where kappa is C infinity positive function and kappa on the boundary is 1. That, by the way, is not very important. Okay? Then our operator A goes into the following operator. Let's call it A kappa, and that is kappa A kappa minus 1. That turns out to be self-adjoint in L2 with measure d mu kappa, where d mu kappa, I hope it's kappa to the power 2, not minus 2, d mu. Or maybe minus 2. Well, operator A kappa is also second order elliptic operator on M. And all because of this just change of gauge transformation, all the eigenvalues of the operator A kappa are the same as eigenvalues of the original operator A. And of course, the eigenfunctions of A kappa are just kappa eigenfunctions of the original operator A. So that's basically unit transformation from one L2 space to the other L2 space, what we have done. And because kappa on the boundary is 1, this implies that Gelfand boundary spectral data of A are the same as Gelfand boundary spectral data of A kappa. And therefore, we see that by no means we can from the boundary differ between A and A kappa. By no means means really by no means, neither by spectral data, nor by hyperbolic data, nor by parabolic data, nor by Schrödinger data, really by no means. So when we were speaking about the change of coordinates, the way out was what to do, to come to the coordinate invariant form. In this case, the way out is to go to the orbits of the group of the gauge transformation. So not consider a particular operator, but consider the orbit of this group. That is not very somehow nice when you want to construct something. So the other way is to find a canonical representation within the orbit. And the canonical representation within the orbit, it turns out that any orbit of a group of gauge transformations contains unique Schrödinger operator. Delta plus Q. Now, of course, here delta is Riemann delta. So this means that there is a, for each orbit, there is a corresponding metric on M and the corresponding potential Q, so that in the orbit there is exactly one Schrödinger operator. Demu. No, well, for this operator, for Schrödinger, yes. For Schrödinger operator, the metric will be just Riemann metric. Yes. This operator will be self-adjoint with respect to just canonical Riemannian metric. But other operator, because, return back, you multiply by kappa squared, so... This, by the way, means that I'll be speaking about Laplace operator, and that's not the most general case. The most general case, you will speak about Schrödinger operator. And in principle, I can speak about Schrödinger operator, but then it will not 5 hours, but 10 hours. So I won't speak about Q. Okay, let me. I'll be explaining how my talk will consist of two parts, hopefully more or less equal. One part about uniqueness and reconstruction, basically using full data, and the other part is will be stability. So the method will be the boundary control method, is in geometric form. Now let me first tell a little bit about the history of this method. The method goes back in one-dimensional case to all the mentioned by Hiroshi papers by Mark Crane. That was in actually late 50s, who was looking for the wave equation for a homogeneous stream. So he was looking for the wave equation for a homogeneous stream. And the idea of Crane's method was to use very systematically finite velocity wave propagation. So hyperbolicity, he used finite velocity wave propagation. The only point, it was very much hidden because he made Fourier transform and then somehow translated into sort of analytical language. So that's, the response Fourier transform should be some analytical function with some properties. A more straightforwardly hyperbolic version of this method was suggested by Blagojevsky. and that was late 60s, beginning 70s. Now, in multidimensional case, for the corresponding equations will be UTT minus C squared of X Laplacian U, this method was generalized to the multidimensional case by Berdyshev. And actually, he understood the role of PDE control for this problem. And this role of PDE control should be emphasized because the cornerstone of the method is the uniqueness theorem of Tataro that Viktor Isakov mentioned today. So let's put here the name of Tataro. And that was, I think, 87. And that is 95. So that's uniqueness theorem of Tataro that somehow underpins the method. For the anisotropic case, more precisely exactly for this problem, for the reconstruction of Riemann manifold, the method was generalized by Berdyshev and myself, and that was 92, and that's for exactly for this Laplace operator. What I'll be going to speak in these lectures will be a geometric version of the method. So geometric version. That was actually developed by Matti Lassus and myself in late 90s. And the first part about uniqueness and construction is actually summarized in the monograph by Kachalov, Lassus, and myself on Gilfand boundary spectral problem. And the part on stability is a joint work with Michael Anderson. Atsushi Katsuda, Marty Lassus, and Michael Taylor. And that's all. Now, it's exactly the end, because I want to add something, but you see, I physically cannot. That it was the following. I also think to give a procedure how to approximately reconstruct the manifold, though it's unclear what you mean by that, starting from incomplete erratic boundary data. And that will be the paper of Atsushi Katsuda, Matti Lassus, and myself, but since I don't have space, I don't have time, because we all know relativity theory. Okay. Now let me come to the first part of my talk, that is uniqueness and reconstruction from complete data. I put it two, because first was introduction, so it's uniqueness. And uniqueness is based on the following representation of the manifold. It is boundary distance representation of manifold. That's the main geometric object. Boundary distance representation. Well, there were quite many times used the word boundary distance. I'm afraid I'll be using it in different way that it was used today before me. So what do I mean? I mean the following thing. Well, let me my manifold, and for some times it will be just ellipse. And let me take any point x in the manifold, and let's consider the following map. I go from x to the function rx of dot, that's continuous function on the boundary. So I associate with any point x a continuous function on the boundary, and that's a very simple function. That's actually the distance from the point x to variable points on the boundary. So rx of z is just the distance from x to z when z varies, belongs to the boundary. Now, we can look for the image of our manifold in continuous function of the boundary. So the image of M in CDM, that is just R of M, is this boundary distance representation of M. So boundary distance representation of the manifold is nothing more than just the image of this map R that corresponds to any point, the distance function to the boundary. Well, to give you a feeling that this is a good thing, this boundary distance representation, let us first, well, let's take two points, x and y, in M. Is the same, L infinity of C. It's actually a continuous function. No, C is better. Or L infinity, yes. So we take two points, X and Y, and then it's just triangular inequality. We have that Rx minus Ry, and this is a continuous function, so we can look for the L infinity norm. As Adrian suggests, it will be less than dxy. So this map is Lipschitz. This map, if consider R of M with a metric inherited from C, so let's consider R of M as a metric space with a metric, I put it called d infinity, and that's the metric inherited from C. Okay? So that's the metric. Now, and the hint that this R is good object, or let's say R with this distance function d infinity, is given by the following lemma. R, consider the map from M, and put here d. Well, so now I consider M as a metric space with a distance that comes from the Riemann structure. To R of M d infinity, so this is homeomorphism. So at least if you know R of M, we immediately know the topological class of the manifold. Well, that's a simple lemma. Moreover, at some later stage, I will need to return to it. That's why let me give a proof, because it's absolutely trivial. So what we have, we already know that this map is continuous and it's automatically surjective, right? Then if you invoke simple topological lemma that we invoke later as well, so I write it here, topological lemma. If you have a map F from X to Y, where X and Y are Hausdorff compacts, and F is continuous and bijective, then F is homeomorphism. Now, what we already have? We already have that F now is R, and X is MD, and Y is R of M is D infinity distance. We know all you have that F is continuous and surjective. So we need to prove only injectivity. So injectivity. Well, assume the contrary. Assume there are two points, X and Y, not equal to each other, such that Rx of Z equals to Ry of Z for any Z on the boundary. Let now the point Z0 will be a point on the boundary which is the nearest to X and Y. This is the same point because we have this identity. So let us choose the point Z0 on the boundary. So Z0 is the point such that dx Z0 equals to dy Z0, and this is actually d from x to the boundary, and this is actually d from y to the boundary. So what happens then? Since the zero is the closest point to the boundary for both X and Y, these points X and Y should lie on the normal geodesic starting from that zero. Okay? And on the same distance, because these are the same. So as soon as geodesics do not branch, X equals to Y. So X equals to Y. That, by the way, let me stress this thing. As soon as geodesics do not branch, x equals to y, and we have injectivity. Now, I definitely delete this piece, but it's a very important piece. So this injectivity we can prove only when geodesics don't branch. So of course it's true for C-infinity manifolds. So the lemma is proven, so we see that R with metric D-infinity is actually homeomorphic to M. That's not enough. Well, actually what we want to do is we want to reconstruct not only topological type, but diffeomorphic, actually, well, we want to reconstruct M up to isometry. And D infinity is not proper candidate for that. So actually we need to introduce metric tensor, introduce differential structure and metric tensor on R of M. Let us do it. And to do this, we introduce boundary normal coordinates. Actually, we already used this boundary normal coordinates when we started with this normal geodesics from the boundary. So let's do it just more systematically. So what we do, we take a point of the boundary and we consider normal geodesic from the boundary, like it looks here. Remember that was ellipse. So we consider normal geodesic from the boundary and S is the arclet's parameter. And then if you look for the distance from the point gamma Z S to the boundary, that in the beginning will be just S. Okay? So the distance from this point to the boundary will be S, and moreover, that will be the only point on the boundary nearest to gamma Z of S. And Z is the closest point. To gamma Z of S. However, when we increase S, there is a critical value. Like in this picture, we continue, when we cut this, interval between, that's ellipse, it's real ellipse. We cut the interval between focal points, then after that, now we are here. The point Z is no more the closest point to the boundary. There is some other point that is closer to the to gamma of Z. So there is a critical value, or actually critical functions, tau of Z, that is cut locus distance function. Such that when S, so such that A, when S is strictly less than tau Z, or tau of Z, then Z is the unique, the closest point of the boundary. But after, when S is strictly more than tau of Z, then it's no more Z than the closest point, and moreover, distance from gamma Z of S to the boundary will be strictly less than S. So we have a cut locus function and we have cut locus. So what is cut locus? Cut locus is just a piece of the manifold omega of the form X such that X equals to gamma Z at the point tau of Z, and we run Z through the boundary. Now for ellipse is just this straight interval between focal points. This is cut locus. And if you look for M minus cut locus, this is the set of full measure. And on this set of full measure, we can introduce boundary normal coordinates. It corresponds to X, Z, and N. So Z is the unique closest point on the boundary, unique closest point on DM, and this is just distance from X to the boundary. Now, in order to cheat you, I'll not be speaking how to introduce differential structure and Riemann tensor on the whole M. I'll show how to introduce it on M minus omega. You can do it, of course you can do it everywhere, but take some more time. What I want to show you now, that having R of M, we can see. So now we have R of M. And from R of N, we can figure out what will be actually R of M minus omega. Look at this picture. We are going along this normal geodesic, and we don't yet hit cut locus. And therefore, for the function, so that's the point x. For this function rx, there is the unique global minimum, the point z. Okay? And moreover, we can go a little bit further to the point y. And for the point y, z will still be the unique global minimum, and the value of Ry at the point Z will be strictly more than the value of the function Rx at the point Z. And that's actually exactly characterization of the points from M minus omega. So let us give it. R belongs to Rm minus omega if and only if, first, R of dot has a unique global minimum, Z,
B, there is R tilde of dot with unique global minimum at Z, at the same point Z, and R dot of Z is strictly more than R of Z. But now we are basically done. We have separated those functions that correspond to m minus omega. But on m minus omega, we know that good coordinates are boundary normal coordinates. So let's do it. So we take function r from r capital m minus omega, and the correspond coordinates z, that's unique global minimizer, and R of Z. Okay? So we go from R to Z, R of Z, and that's actually boundary normal coordinates for the point X that corresponds to R. Okay, so that's differential structure. Now what about Riemann structure? We can do this as well. So Riemann tensor. Let us just look in a different way on what we have done now. What we have at our disposal? We have points Z and N, where Z belongs to the boundary and N is less than tau of Z. Okay? To this point, the corresponds the functions R that lies in R M minus omega. Okay? And what is R? What gives us R? R is actually the distance, R of omega. Now I put omega as a point on the boundary. Now, because that is all used, I use here R of omega as a point on the boundary. R of omega will be nothing more as the distance from Zn to omega zero. Okay, so let me draw the picture. So that's our boundary. That point Zn. And this point, omega. So what we have is these distances from Zn to various points on the boundary. That is R Zn of variable omega. Up to now, we were fixing Zn and varying omega. Now we do different thing. We now fix omega and vary Zn. So now we are looking at this as a function. Consider this as a function of Zn for fixed omega. Well, we can take a differential of this function. Because unfortunately I already used the letter D for differential, I use delta. So let's look for the delta Zn of the function D dot omega. Dot means that we vary Zn and omega is fixed now. That belongs to T star Zn
of R m minus omega. But D is distance function. So originally, the length of this differential was 1. So we know that if our metric on this R m minus omega is such that this map R is isometry, then the length of this differential should be 1. Okay? So we know that what we want to do, well, that D Z n equals to 1, actually for any omega. Well, for any omega when this differential exists, of course. Now, what is the metric tensor in boundary normal coordinates? The metric tensor in boundary normal coordinates, I put it this way. DL squared equals to DN squared plus G alpha beta of ZN DZ alpha dz beta. Okay. Of course, I need to introduce some local coordinates on the boundary near my point z, z1, z2, zm, zm minus 1. So now we vary omega, varying omega, omega, we obtain a neighborhood. Of the vector 0, 0, 1. So when we take z, when we take omega equal to z, it will be exactly the normal. Okay? And we know that this neighborhood actually belongs to the unit cosphere, beg your pardon. This neighborhood lies in the unit cosphere because quadratic form, actually because it's an analytic function, we can find coefficients. So from here, we find G alpha beta. Again, what we have? We have the value of analytic function, more or less quadratic form, on the piece of the unit sphere, on the open neighborhood. So of course, you can find the corresponding coefficients. So we are done, up to the fact that we don't yet know what to do near omega. Well, fine. No, it's like, should we always start that we don't know? Okay, and that's the end of the first hour, and then we continue after the break.